Please stand by. Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Kopernik Global Investors fourth quarter 2021 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Qasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead, Mr. Ghaffar.
Thank you, operator. Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the fourth quarter 2021 conference call. I have with me David Ivan, our CIO and Portfolio Manager for the Kopernik Global All-Cap Strategy and Co-PM for the International Strategy, and Alisa Cochran, our Deputy CIO and Director of Research and Analyst. Before I pass the call to David and Alisa, I'll be providing a quick firm update. Kopernik ended the year with overall firm assets of roughly $7 billion. This is an impressive increase over the past 12 months when our assets under management were right around $5.2 billion at the beginning of 2021. This increase was due to strong inflows of over $1 billion+ during the year, combined with strong market appreciation from our portfolios. We have seen a continued increase in demand for our style of management as several of the allocators are taking profit from their growth and U.S.-specific managers and deploying it with managers like ourselves. Moving along on the personnel side, no changes to report. We ended the year being 43 employees strong and have continued to be stable with minimal turnover since inception of the firm. That brings us to an end to the business update. Please note, Dave and Alisa will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website, kopernikglobal.com, under the News and View section. With that, I'll pass the call over to Dave. Dave, please go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Qasim, and thanks everybody for joining us. Good afternoon, and welcome to 2022. Market's off to an interesting start. Couldn't have come up with a better picture than this to describe the current market environment and the economy. The good news is that we'll spend a lot of time later telling you why we think there's a lot of great opportunities in the market and why it's ideally suited for what we do. First, I'm gonna tell you why both this market and this economy is very worrisome to me. Came up with this listening to Spotify, hearing a song from 1972 by Leon Russell. Many of you are too young to know this song about a tightrope. He's up on a high wire. One side's ice and one side's fire. We've got Jerome Powell here on the tightrope, and on one side there's a torrent of water coming in, and of course, they've come up with a tidal wave of money that's gonna counteract this or so it's hoped. They've done an incredible job for a number of years now of balancing on that wire. But the forces wanting to pull it down into ice are pretty strong, which is why these monetary forces they've unleashed in recent years are also very strong as this all collides on us. Which way do we go? A lot of smart people say ice. They say deflation, depression. This would be tough because valuations would normalize and capital would be written off. Enthusiasm would go to the other side of their bipolar disorders. Central planning yet fails again. We'll see. Now a lot of other smart people say, "No, no. Inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomena. The money supply is up almost 10x since they unleashed it in 2008." After the lag, the famous lags, it's starting to migrate into things other than just assets. Certainly the price of assets are up 5x-10x in many cases. Now we're starting to see it drip into even the CPI, and certainly we all see what's doing to real estate stocks, bonds, you name it, in recent years. If we go into that side, then if rates get dragged up, multiples fall, purchasing power gets hurt. People are gonna wanna migrate to things that preserve that purchasing power. History suggests that inflation and stagflation come with increasing social unrest. Financial assets tend to struggle in that environment. So turning to Christine Lagarde and the quantities of errors we've seen from central banks, which side are we going to fall on, the weak side or the strong side? We figure after 40 years of magnificent increases in stocks and bonds and real estate and alts and you name it, it's hard to see most asset classes winning on either side if we go into a deflationary collapse. Bonds theoretically would do well, except for we all know there's too much debt to be paid off in a weak economy, so there will be defaults. Stocks likely fall with earnings. Alts struggle with the economy. Real estate has to deal with vacancies. History does show that gold tends to do well. It went up substantially in the 1930s, substantially in the 1970s. It went up a year and a half ago when things were struggling, and also in 2008-09 where things were struggling. If we go into the inflationary thing, bonds famously don't do well in inflation, especially from zero interest rates. Stocks, earnings go up, but the multiples in the past have collapsed more than that. Alts struggle with the rising cost of capital. Real estate does okay, except for the cap rates rise, taking away a lot of those gains. Gold, of course, has done very well in inflationary environments. So interesting time. The song also goes on to talk about the altitude that really gets to me. We're value people through and through. The altitude is really getting to us. We could show you about 50 different ways of measuring the markets, and in almost every case, it's the most expensive market in the history of our country, if not the history of mankind. So we have the amount of hours needed to work to earn enough money to buy one unit of the S&P. That is a tenfold. People have to work 10 times as many hours to buy the S&P as they did a number of years ago. If you look at it on replacement, also a new all-time high, sixfold increase since I came into the business. All this has made people's net worth go up as a percentage of S&P. That's good, except for often money printing creates the illusion of wealth rather than real wealth. We'll only do a few more things here. If we look at it, price to book value, it's gone up threefold. Tangible book, though, it's almost infinite. The U.S. Doesn't seem to have a lot of tangible book left. So we'll see what that means going forward. The equities to GDP gets a lot of press because of Buffett always saying he liked it. He was a little afraid in 1999 when it got so high. 1999 almost looks cheap compared to now. So equities are a claim on the profits of the economy. That's gone up seven times. And equities are junior to bonds. And bonds' claim on the economy now is up tremendously, like three times the economy. And then government's claims on the economies are the highest in the record of our country. And it's pretty much the same across Europe and other places. So we could go on all day. We won't. About different ways that the market is the most expensive it's ever been. So a lot of good things out there, why it should be expensive, but this is really expensive, no margin for error. But outside of that, how's the economy going to do? A lot of people have written about the tendency of debasing the money to debase society as a whole. We've always been fans of Dylan Grice. He writes a lot about the history of social cohesion during currency debasements and suggests further debasement will cause further debasement of society. But a lot of people we know talk a lot about the world right now seems kind of unreal. Beyond crazy, the things are going on out there, whether people are on the right or left of the aisle. I think everybody agrees, strange economy out there. Keynes, Lenin, and other people put it a long time ago. Inflation is confiscation of money by the governments. It's secret. It's unobserved. It treats people differently. Hurts most people. Helps the rich, which leads to more conflict. Most people don't know what's going on. So it should be no surprise that you look around the world and see more conflict lately. I could go on for the next hour, but I'll leave it up to people on their own if they're interested in the subject of the madness of crowds and what happens to society when people all get mesmerized by a market or about science and that not. Gustav Le Bon, Dietrich Bonhoeffer back in the 1930s, 40s, Germany had some very interesting things about the mass psychosis he was witnessing. And many of these calls have references to extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds, three major stock market bubbles, but also weird things, you know, witch hunts and crusades and a lot of other things. So society right now is mesmerized by a lot of things, good, bad, I don't know, but it adds unknowns. And the market is supposed to care about clarity. It's hard to have clarity when you see this level of debt growth, debt borrows from the future, famously. So there's too much paper out there, too much debt, too much paper that's going to try to pay off that debt. As the Fed's balance sheets explode, it's also brought the price of assets up. You can see the stock market is up in lockstep. This could be viewed bullishly, that maybe stocks have gone up like they ought to. We won't argue that. What we'll say is some stocks are too cheap, some stocks are too expensive. But more importantly, there's a lot of very valuable, useful assets that have not gone up tenfold with the money supply. And arguably they will. And some of them haven't gone up at all with the money supply. So we see a lot of opportunity out there. And we also see a lot of risk because all-time high valuations, if the market in fact likes clarity, I don't know that there's been more opacity in my lifetime anyhow. So we will see how high valuations collide with murkiness about the future. But, you know, the central banks are here to save us. The people that have created this mess are going to guide us to safety, which reminds me of the good Homer Simpson quote that alcohol is both the cause of and the solution to all our problems. I guess that could be said about central bankers now. So we have a picture here. We've tried to include Powell and Christine Lagarde and Kuroda from Japan. We've got the Chinese bankers. We've got not the banker, but Erdogan in Turkey, who fashions himself a central banker. So these are our saviors. If that's the case, we suggest people look for a safety net and see where we're finding both safety and opportunity. Let's hand it off to Elisa Corcoran, our deputy CIO.
Thanks, Dave. Yes, as Dave pointed out, there's a lot in the market today. There are a lot of situations that seem to be very unstable, and so we recommend that investors have some sort of safety net to protect on the downside. And owning negatively correlated companies is one such safety net. Owning things that are negatively correlated that have positive optionality is an even better safety net. So gold, as Dave pointed out, can do well in times of uncertainty. Either way we fall off of this high wire, we think gold will do well. And the gold miners have even more optionality. So to demonstrate this concept, we'll go through Seabridge, which is a company that owns one of the largest undeveloped gold copper deposits in the world. It has 50 million ounces of gold, 14 billion pounds of copper, with only a market cap of 1.3 billion. You compare this to some of the tech stocks that we see, the valuation is quite the difference. This company has all of its permits. It's basically shovel ready. It just needs a partner because it has a lot of CapEx needed to build this project. So at current prices, we don't think we lose much. If gold were to go back to 1500 and stay there forever, we probably lose our investment. However, we think that is highly unlikely because we think that gold should revert back to a normal price where it versus the monetary base, versus the money supply. And in those situations, we make 55 times our money. That's incredible optionality. So obviously, there's a lot of risk with mining companies, which is why we own a diversified portfolio. And we heavily discount this. We will be out of the stock before it goes up 55 times. But it does demonstrate the opportunity set that we're seeing in today's market. And we've talked about this before, but why do we see this opportunity set? For starters, the industry standard values mining companies. They use DCF models, which is just another way of saying that people prefer seeing the cash flows today versus the cash flows that will come in 10 years, which even if they are much higher 10 years from now. So you can see the stark valuation differences between the producing mining companies, such as Newmont and Barrick, versus Seabridge. We're getting a huge discount on the price per ounce when you buy something that is not producing. We've talked to many mining companies over time, and they all want to improve their NPV by doubling their mining production. But we say, well, you've just cut the mine life in half, which is problematic when you're dealing with optionality because time is our friend. We discussed the weather example in previous quarterly calls, but it's worth repeating. If we are going to make a bet that it will rain 6 inches in a month in Tampa, over enough time, it's highly likely that we're going to be right. And the same is true for gold. If we bet that the gold price is going to fully price in that monetary increase, that monetary inflation immediately, we're assuredly going to be wrong. But with enough time, the probability of an event can change from highly unlikely to highly, highly probable. So that is how we feel about gold. With enough time, we should see gold revert back to what the fundamentals suggest it should be priced. And so when you're dealing with scarce, underpriced goods, historical stores of value, we're suggesting that investors consider using a Black-Scholes model where option time is our friend rather than discounting gold like you do cash flows. So with fiat currencies, we agree, you should discount these. The central banks and governments around the world have a very strong track record of debasing your currency. Just in the past year, my $100 is now worth 7% less because of the printing presses. So what we think is that investors have taken this concept of discounting cash and applied it to discounting stores of value, which we believe is a mistake. If gold is the non-correlated positive optionality, it's worth pointing out that bonds are the exact opposite of that. You're making negative real returns today. Pretty much in any scenario, investors are going to lose money. So there's a lot of negative optionality with bonds. So we like gold for many reasons, but it's not just gold. The fundamentals for other scarce, useful assets is also positive. You can see that global population is going to continue to increase, and therefore the demand for food, for energy, for materials will also grow. And with the monetary base increasing, when you have things priced in dollars per barrel or dollars per pound or dollars per ounce, if you double the numerator, the dollars, but you don't double the denominator, you can just imagine what that looks like in terms of pricing these scarce goods in terms of dollars. So taking farmland as an example, we believe the fundamentals are good for farmland, as we've shown. The difference in valuation when you step outside of the U.S. is very stark, and you can see this with Astarta, which is a Ukrainian farming company. The Iowa farmland is clearly pricing in these positive fundamentals, but you step outside, you go to Ukraine, you can get a 98% discount. So this is incredible valuation discrepancy. Moving outside of hard assets, we agree with GMO's forecast that EM value offers the best opportunities, and so we have a significant percentage of our portfolio in emerging markets. We'd like to point out that many of the BRICS are trading 10% lower than they were last year, excluding India. Russia is down 30% in just the past couple months, and China is the same level as it was in 2007. So we view that there's a lot of opportunities in here. As an active investor, we can really take advantage of the times when the market is dumping entire industries or dumping entire countries and find the best companies with the best valuations. So when you look at our traditional value, which are many of these companies, we're owning oligopolies, we're owning things that are leaders in their industries, we're buying them at half of book value and a 4.5% dividend yield. So we're very happy with these sorts of valuations. We're very happy with the valuations on our portfolio. We're trading at less than book value, 12 times earnings, which is cheap on its own right and much cheaper than the market. Same with international. And just before I hand it back over to Dave, I'll just point out a couple of areas that we're seeing opportunities. We're seeing some opportunities in small cap Japan. Kyorin is one example. It's 40% of sales, and they have one of the leading asthma drugs, a 3% dividend yield. There's significant upside should multiples and margins mean revert. Fukuda is a company in Japan with negative enterprise value. So if you take all of their current assets and subtract out all of their obligations, that's more than the current market cap today. So we're getting this business effectively for free. Suzukin is another example. It's the third largest drug distributor in Japan. It's trading at 7% of sales, which is a third cheaper than what you can find in the U.S., and 70% of book value. And some of these U.S. distribution companies, they don't even have tangible book value. Finally, one of the new names that we've added is WH Group, which is one of the largest pork processors and producers in the world. It's 30% of the market share in the U.S. Insiders are buying. It's cheap on all metrics, earnings, book value. It has a 3.5% dividend yield. So these are some examples of the opportunities that we're finding today.
All right. And just to add on to that, we always say one of the things that we are different than a lot of people out there, we view volatility not as risk, but as opportunity. The volatility has allowed us now, as Elisa pointed out, to buy some of these smaller cap stocks at unbelievable cheap prices. So that's really good. But then, you know, as we've talked about in recent calls, you know, how interesting within resources that we could be selling things in early 2020, buying them back at half price 2 months later on the COVID outbreak, then watching our gold stocks shoot up tremendously in 3 or 4 months, trimming them substantially, and being able to buy at really low prices companies that had a lot of copper, because we were going into a depression, everybody was pretty sure. We were being able to buy natural gas for next to nothing, able to buy uranium for next to nothing. It was, even oil became really cheap there for a while. Just 5 quarters ago, people were pretty sure that right about now we wouldn't be using hydrocarbons anymore. Now we're back to peak demand. So this has given us opportunity to do that. But more recently in this quarter, the things we were buying in the summer of 2020, we've had nice profits on Ivanhoe Mines. There are more copper, all-time highs now. We are trimming that. We are very happy to buy not just uranium, but some of the smaller ones that have the massive optionality that Elisa talked about. Next gen, we've been trimming from the bottom last year to the top, or the bottom in 2020 to the top the last quarter, tenfold increase. Same thing with Vision Range was interesting. That went up, I think, 12 times from last 2020 to last quarter. Well, we trimmed it, and we're able to buy some of it back again the next month at a big discount to what we trimmed at. Those are the things we like. Synovus Energy we've been able to trim. So that's the sort of thing that volatility allows people to do. And so that we're pretty happy about. A couple more slides, and then we've saved most of the time for Q&A because in this environment, we imagine you have a lot of questions. We talked about Black-Scholes sort of value of optionality with big, big upside, but for people that say, nah, we want to stick with the high RR-based approach to things, here's a chart we've showed you many, many times. If we have companies that are trading at half a book and they're good companies and go to book value someday, that's a double. Double this year is great, but we have to wait 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, double-digit returns. So under optionality or under more old-school ways of valuing things, I think this portfolio has tremendous upside. If, in fact, we're on a high wire, and that includes, you know, most bonds and most stocks and many alts and this bubble and everything we hear about, we always like to be a little away from the crowd. But if there's ever a time to not be part of the crowd, this is it. So we think this is the time to get out of the correlated stuff and into things that are really, really undervalued, which we've discussed some of them. And then we show you this one. We are very different than the crowd. We have nothing in the U.S. other than a couple gas names. We have a lot more in the growing parts of the world, the emerging markets, than the market does. And Asia, as Alisa shows you, for the massive, massive growth in China, Hong Kong, to see the Hong Kong index lower than it was in 2007. So we're starting to buy some things there. We find that interesting. Energy, something that was considered untouchable a year and a half ago, still a big position for us. We went to our only time in my 40-year career we got anywhere near 25% was last year. We've trimmed that back aggressively, but it's still undervalued in a good position. Materials continues to be a high position, but we talked about that's been migrating from the industrial metals as they go up back into gold that's been in a bear market for, 20 months now, something like that. So fascinating time, good time to be different, good time to be focused on things that others aren't, like long-term versus short-term, optionality versus misappropriated DCF, growing parts of the world versus the mature, expensive economies. And so we're feeling pretty good about where we are, pretty good about avoiding the crowds. And with that, let's talk questions.
Thank you. If you would like to signal with questions, please press *1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're joining us today using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is *1. If you would like to signal with questions, *1. And our first question will come from Jerry Klein with Merrill Lynch.
Dave, thank you again for a great presentation. Curious as to your thoughts on the current Russia-Ukraine situation, and I know you're not a political scientist, but what potential impact do you think that might have on global commodity prices, if any?
Yeah. You know, with a lot of value investing, people ask us, how do we get comfortable with things? And we say we actually get paid for discomfort. We're willing to buy things that are slightly discomfortable only during times where the crowd goes to extremes and rushes to the exit. When it comes to both geopolitics and commodities, we're not foolish enough to have the answer, but we believe we can have a range of likely possibilities. So We don't know whether oil should be 70, but it's likely to be between 50 and 100. And when it gets above 100, you won't find us in it. When it gets to 20, like last year, we're in it. When it comes to geopolitics, do we know what's going to happen, especially in this world with all the inequality and diciness? Just like we saw in 2008-09 with the Arab Spring, I think you'll consider to see unrest. And famously, I don't know a lot about geopolitics, but I know what the first thing they're taught is when things aren't good at home, go blame somebody else. And so with a lot of problems around the world, I think us and the Russians and the Chinese and everybody else are going to be pointing fingers. What we do is say, well, what is reasonable? And, with Russia back in 2015, we're not quite there yet again, but in 2015, we had watched the transition from people's view back in 2011, which Lisa referenced, where people said, you must own Russia. It was part of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. China was going to need all of Russia's resources, and you should buy it. It's an emerging market. It's a growth economy. No price is too high. Too, in 2015, we ran into lots of value investors who said, yeah, we love Russia, but we will not buy it at any price. Not at any price. And we're thinking, wow, that's music to our ears. So we say, what do we know? What we don't know. We don't know the future. We do know that Russia is famously corrupt. We know that it has hundreds of years of instability and turmoil. We know in some ways their government and ours still kind of continue. The Cold War is still being there, so that political skirmishes seem to happen now and then, over and over and over. And also, I think we're going to compete with Russia on who gets to sell gas to Europe and those sort of things. So we know there's going to be skirmishes. We know that they'll have laws that we don't care for. And so there's reasons we would just as soon not deal with that. So we'd rather not invest there either. But as people realized in 2011, they do have a lot of commodities, and the world needs a lot of commodities. So Alicia showed the slide where the population that in my lifetime has gone from 3 billion people to 7.5 billion will be at 8 billion before too long. Russia has oil, they have gas, they have metals, they have agriculture land, they have stuff the world needs, they're very good at it. They have world-class companies, and Gazprom is far and away the best gas company in the world in terms of costs and reserves and infrastructure to where the gas is going to be converted. Sberbank might be the best bank in the world on a lot of measures. They have cheap, clean electricity with hydroelectric and whatnot. Smart population, educated population, hardworking. So there's a lot of things to like. So we've said, all right, we want a 50% discount. We're not going to argue with people that say it should be 70 or with people that say 30 is enough. When you get times like 2015 where a Gazprom was, in our view, 95% off sale, that's too much. We're starting to see that again now. We're starting to see people pour to the exits. We don't know what the future means. We know that the U.S. is saying we think they're going to invade. In Russia, it seems to be damn near 100% of the population thinks they're not going to invade. We do know that the U.S. sent a bunch of troops to the border half a year ago. I imagine there'll be a lot of talk back and forth. It would surprise us if there was an invasion. But there'll be lots of political back and forth, probably. Usually neither the Russians or us are going to be really stupid. And going to war would be really stupid. And so probably not going to happen. That doesn't mean definitely won't, but it's outside a reasonable expectation. And so We were able to trim a lot of our Russian stocks 4 or 5 months ago, and now we can buy these things back one-third off. So we like buying best-in-the-world companies one-third off of where they were a few months ago. Over the years, we've been able to add and trim, and do pretty well in some really good agricultural companies. Alicia showed you one of them. They have really good properties. They tend to be really profitable over time. They're a lot cheaper than they were a few weeks ago. Question that might come up sooner, so let's just take it now, is Kazakhstan, which is very much the same way. People were not too sure of it a few years ago, which allowed us to buy Kazatom from it at very, very cheap prices. It more than doubled. So we were able to take a few profits there. Now it's got a little cheaper again. Like Russia, authoritarian government, it does some smart things, it does some less smart things. Not our first choice on where to be, but also like Russia, the debt to GDP is a small fraction of what the U.S. and Europe and Japan and China have, a very, very small fraction. Growing economies with lots of resources, good economies over time. They had their uprising that seemed to go away after a day or two. Maybe that's like buying the U.S. a year and a half ago when some of our cities seemed to be on fire. So we do not have the answers, but when society gets really, really afraid, they're almost always wrong. When they get really, really euphoric, like they were a few months ago on many things, tech and Meta and those sort of things, they're usually wrong there. So once again, a very long answer on my part, but a very important question you're asking. It's, yeah, we just focus on the times when the crowd is extreme of what probably will happen.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Glenn Arnold with Morgan Stanley. And again, Glenn Arnold, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi, sorry about the delay. I just had it on mute. Same question, basically, on the China-Taiwan situation. Thank you.
There again, people have always correctly said China's a booming economy with 1.3 billion people, many of them industrious, many of them smart. They're shaking the world with their growth, creating a lot of best-in-breed companies, a place where in 2007 it was pretty much unanimous you had to be there. And all those positives are still there, which that was a mere 4 years after 2003 when people said, don't be there, Tiananmen Square, child labor, all that, SARS-1, and all that. But as we pointed out, 14 years of rapid growth, and the Hong Kong index is lower than it was then, and the CSI is not much higher than it was then. Certainly, it's more interesting now, because now people are saying, wow, these guys are corrupt, and they're causing problems, and causing problems not just with Taiwan, but all around the neighboring countries in the South China Sea. You see them detaining tennis players for speaking out, and reporters disappear, and whether there's forced labor or not is another controversial subject. So just don't own China. So to us, when everybody said you must own it, they reflected those views in the prices they were paying for the stock. Now when people have these worries, the stocks are a lot cheaper. They're a lot more interesting. So we heavily risk adjust these companies and say, all right, this is a good company, but we want 40, 50, 60% discount depending on the company. We're starting to see that. We're starting to buy stocks there. There again, emotions are their own thing, and they're so a lot vested in that they want Taiwan and they think it's there. So on the other hand, they're not stupid. Attacking Taiwan seems like it would be very stupid with huge repercussions. Probably not going to happen. That doesn't mean definitely not going to happen. If we can buy really, really cheap stocks in China and in Russia and in Kazakhstan and in various other controversial parts around the world, and including the U.S. and Canada and other things, and lots of good companies and good industries and good companies, and we're buying them, but these huge risk-adjusted things, the things that probably won't happen, by definition, probably won't happen, but if they happen one place, but we're making two, three, four times our money in other places, the math works really well. We've seen this over the people that were with us even back in 2008 got to see that. You know, we had companies where we got burned in Venezuela and Bolivia that still had a career year in 2009 when everything was just booming. We had companies going up 4 times, 7 times, 10 times, and we had a similar thing in 2016 where we had an unfortunate experience where the management colluded with a hedge fund to effectively steal one of our big holdings, but a lot of our other holdings went to the moon that year. It was one of our better years. After we bought Russia the last time, people were scared to death. It's been the best up until a few months ago, the best performing market in the world. A lot better than the S&P even. So we were rewarded for buying that. And we've had that where people really didn't like Korea a year and a half ago. That was an opportunity. They really disliked Japan immensely in 2012. And we put 25% of the portfolio in Japanese companies. They went to the moon. So I'm not saying we're going to be right on any one of these things. I'm saying that when the world prices in a sure or almost sure thing for things that probably aren't going to happen, that means we're going to make a lot of money if they don't happen, maybe don't lose that much if they do happen because it's somewhat priced in, and most of the time they won't happen. So if we can replicate lots of good companies at really distressed prices across 100 different companies, and lots of different industries and geographies, the math works.
And our next question will come from Bradley Calder with the Investment Fund for Foundations.
Hi, Lisa and Dave. I wanted to get both of your takes on a debate that we've been having at TIFF. We've read that starting last year, passive investing in the U.S. public markets has surpassed more than 51% of the market by assets, and passive funds receive the majority of new inflows into the market as well. Therefore, to what extent do you believe this will result in permanent lock-in effect on market caps of the largest, most liquid companies that are the most represented in the index? And are there any other effects of the majority of capital being passively managed that we should be aware of? Thanks.
Yeah, we've written pieces in the past. It's interesting how some things can be really good ideas when almost nobody's doing it. And then once everybody starts doing it, it becomes a really bad idea. On its side, it doesn't matter that much, but yes, capital gets locked in and money's pouring into the indexes month after month. Of course, those same stocks are going to go up month after month. That's understood. But that means when the indexes start selling, these stocks are going to go down. And month after month, as happened after the indexing was very popular in 1999, and the equivalent of indexing with all the trust companies back in 72, same thing. You know, perpetual motion machines don't work. And so these things at these prices require the money to come in. But more importantly than that, you know, our opinion on that doesn't really matter. What I think matters is that people say the markets are efficient. They're efficient because we have lots of hardworking people that are very smart, that have equal access to information and pour through it and come up to a price that's somewhat fair. And because they're all doing that, prices come up to a fair price. And so since we've all kept the market at a fair price, people can index and get a free ride. Why should they pay the fees so that we can do all the work? They can just take a free ride on the work that we all collectively have done to make the market fair. So then more people start doing it, and more people, well, why not? You actually get the same performance for without paying the fees. Obvious, do it. Then more and more people start doing it, which means a couple of things. One, less and less people are still doing the research, so that it's no longer the assumptions of an efficient market aren't there anymore because people aren't doing the research anymore. And the stocks that are in the indexes actually start to outperform the market because all this money goes in it. And people take that as a positive. Look, these are actually, I'm getting the free ride and doing better than the market, as opposed to saying, ha, the market's not efficient anymore and these things have become way more expensive than the market. And so they're making a mistake. And then you get to the wild extremes we have right now, in our opinion, where very few people are actually rolling up their sleeves and doing the analysis anymore. You know, famously after 1929, a few years after that, if you read Graham and Dodd, they talked about in the late 1920s doing research not only wasn't helpful, it was harmful. It would keep you from buying the stocks that were working and you would end up getting fired. And 1999 became like that. And the last few years have felt like that to value investors. It's like, wow, all this work to do the valuation, and it's just hurting because that means we don't get to buy all these companies that are trading on emotions and euphoria that don't seem to even have fundamental underpinnings. And so at times like that are the times we're very biased on this, but times like now when people should be screaming out of the index and going to the people that are actually doing the research and buying these stocks that don't have the problems you mentioned or the problems we mentioned, you know, instead of, you know, capital being locked in these things, why not go back to, you know, the way I was taught in ancient times, I guess, that we're actually owners of businesses and we should understand the business and want to be an owner of it and want to do it at a price that's likely to leave us with a really good return going forward. And the big index stocks maybe don't offer that anymore.
And our next question will come from Ross Jagar with Equitable Trust.
Thanks, Dave. Question for you on the S&P puts. Saw you trimmed them in December. Did you bring them back a little bit so far this quarter? How are we looking now?
Yeah. All along, we buy these like we do with everything. It doesn't have anything to do with our views of the market. It has to do with what is the fair price of a put. And, yeah, maybe the fair price is 20 implied vol, but we would rather not pay above 14 implied vol, and we've historically only done it between 8 and 14 implied vol. So we did that. The bad news was that the market kept going up for 3 years, and the good news was the beauty of paying a low price is that we made back 3 years of losses in a couple of weeks in March of 2020. Then we didn't do this for a long time, didn't think we'd see the vault get down there again. Then we did last year, and there was, four or five months where we actually were able to buy these things very cheap. And so that cost some money for the mutual fund. And now the implied vol has skyrocketed. And so the market may or may not be in a correction phase right now. And if it is, we're going to miss that. We do not have the put because we couldn't afford the put. And why it's unfortunate, you know, everybody knew the market's probably overdue for a correction, but there's been plenty of times in the past where it seemed overdue for a correction where it would have cost us a lot of money to pay high implied vols. We do think the market's quite likely to fall, but we're not top down. We will not buy the put back until the implied vol gets low. So not in the put now.
And once again, if you would like to signal with questions, please press star 1. Again, that is star 1 if you would like to signal with questions at this time. And our next question will come from David Nyhaus with Merrill Lynch.
Hey, David and Alyssa. Happy New Year.
Hi.
Just had a question about the valuation of the portfolio. Can you just give us some perspective on where the current valuation sits relative to the history there at Copernic? Are we kind of bottom half, bottom quarter, average, whatever? Thank you.
Sure. I would say that January of 2016 and March of 2020 are maybe the cheapest portfolios I've ever had in my career, and that I was in the bottom in 2082. So we are up strongly from March of 2020, so this is not at the bottom. From our time at Copernic, and value stocks have been pretty cheap the whole time, I would say we're in the bottom half of cheapness for the time we've been there. And if you throw in what I saw back in the last decade, it's cheaper than most of those times. We had a cheaper portfolio in 2002, that's for sure. So 2002 was cheaper. Outside of that, you know, out of the last 35, 40 years, this is probably bottom quartile in terms of this is interesting, just like 2002 or 99, those 3 year period, in one of the more expensive markets in history. In 99, we were selling at a big discount to book value. Now, as you saw earlier, we're trading well below or we're trading below book value. We're trading low on almost every metric. To our valuations, I think we show the quality, the big quality phone companies and trading companies and hydroelectric companies and whatnot. We have a 4.5% dividend yield and really low PE. On the rest of the portfolio, that latent value we've been talking about, the idea that these stocks are undervalued if turns out printing money is not inflationary, but if these things go up at all to what we think a fair price is for uranium and natural gas and gold and those sort of things, massive upside there. When you add it all up, our portfolio is worth double what it's trading at now. So that is good at any point in time, but for us, pretty spectacular during the bubble and everything to have a portfolio that's trading at half of what it's worth. And half of what it's worth after our margin of safety, which our margin of safety is tend to be big on mining companies and big on, as you heard earlier, on the emerging markets. And so, we think these things are worth double after major haircuts.
And our next question will come from Anthony Thornley with Merrill Lynch.
Hi, Dave. My question is, do you think that the current substantial interest in Bitcoin and other digital currencies has a significant effect on the value of gold?
Bitcoin is interesting. We like a lot of what other people like about it, which is that it's supposedly scarce. However, the scarcity is being driven by an algorithm, which we don't trust. So we prefer the time-tested value, the time-tested version, which is gold, and it's geologically scarce. That's been proven over thousands of years. There are now, I don't know, thousands of cryptocurrencies. So how do you know which winner you're going to get? And it does seem to be highly speculative. It does seem to rise when markets are rising. And so will it act the same way when there's more uncertainty in the market? I guess time will tell. We do think that there's a lot of space for stores of value. So will Bitcoin take all of the market share that gold? We think that's highly unlikely. We think that there's plenty of room for both, especially as people in bonds start to demand a positive real return. Right now, they're getting negative real returns and in some cases negative nominal returns. So, we think there's plenty of room for both.
Yeah, and it's interesting if the Fed falls off the high wire. if you look at just my lifetime, I think the dollar's lost 95% of its value, and that's before they came up with all the various QEs. So we have a lot of sympathy for people that are looking for all other stores of value. So if we had a choice of taking a bunch of dollars and put it in a safe deposit box and checking in on it in 30 years or owning Bitcoin, we would take Bitcoin. The dollar's a almost assured loser. Bitcoin versus gold, I mean, Bitcoin can be a spectacular win or it can go to zero. Where gold is just going to be pretty boring and go up as fast as they print the money. And by buying gold in the ground, we get massive optionality over that. So Bitcoin's interesting. Gold's somewhat a close to a sure thing, as you'll find, I think. And then I know people that like gold that have moved some of their funds to crypto, so certainly it's affecting it. But if the dollar's losing lots of value, and it seems to be, people are going to be fleeing the dollar into lots of things like they did in the 70s. If crypto's 1% of people's assets and gold is 1% of assets, is the competition really between the two of them? Or is it various quasi-scarce forms of stores of value versus the proven non-stores of value that the fiat currencies are? So we're agnostic on Bitcoin, negative on fiat currencies, positive on stores of value.
And once again, if you would like to signal with questions, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Our next question will come from Glenn Arnold with Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, my question was just posed to you, so thank you.
Thank you.
And moving on to Daniel Morgan with IFP.
Hey, thank you for hosting the call. I have three things, actually, that I'd like you to hit on, but they can just be really fast if you want to at the time we have. The first is Brazil. Just wanted to know, things seem to be changing there. what your thoughts are with that one. The second is interest rate increases this year. What impact would that have on the global portfolio? And then finally, you hit on the dollar a minute ago, but this year, next year, what do you see for the dollar and how would that impact the international and global portfolios? Thank you.
Sure, quickly, Brazil, it's the same as the earlier conversations on China, Russia, Kazakhstan, other things. We see lots of potential, lots of problems. We tend to want big margins of safety. Last time we looked, the best investment we've had over the last 8.5 years has been Eletrobras, which has been very volatile. Thank God we wanted a big margin of safety because we didn't own much when it fell 90% when Dilma Rousseff made them lose money. Then it came back sevenfold in 1 year. It was a big position at that point. We did very well. We've been able to trade it since. There's other things that are starting to look interesting. We're looking there. There and other emerging markets, why the U.S. is just starting to falter from all-time highs. A lot of the world is at major distress prices. So Brazil's pretty interesting. Interest rates are a fascinating thing. Interest rates go up, it's going to be very bad for bonds and most stocks. But people are wrong to think that rising interest rates are bad for gold. Interest rates went from a few percent to 20% in the 1970s, and gold went from 35 to 800. Interest rates plunged for the next couple of decades as gold went from 800 down to 255. What matters is not interest rates, it's real interest rates. Gold didn't falter until Volcker took the rates way above the inflation rate. Inflation rate now is, 7%, probably in reality much higher. If rates go to 10%, that's bad for gold. If rates go to 3 or 4%, arguably gold should do really well because that's still massively negative real interest rates, but would clearly be horrible for bonds and for some stocks. So when interest rates go up, what's it mean for the portfolio? It depends upon whether it's real interest rates going up or nominal. Most of the whole world believes that central banks will not allow positive real interest rates. We have no reason to think those people are wrong. The third question was, could you repeat the third? Oh, the dollar, right? We believe that printing dollars makes it worth less, and you've seen that it takes way more dollars than it did a couple of years ago to buy the S&P or the NASDAQ or a house or rents or medical care or uranium or gas. So the dollar has been losing its value, presumably will keep losing its value. That doesn't mean it loses value versus the euro or the yen or that we're agnostic to which one of these currencies is going to fall faster. But they all probably will keep losing value relative to scarce, useful assets.
And our next question will come from Ron Tandon with Libra Advisors.
Hi, David. I wanted to ask you, you invest in a portfolio of diversified companies, equities primarily. If you were to look at the underlying commodity for some of these companies such as uranium, copper, gold, energy, or agriculture, how would you rank it? Because you get a benefit from the valuation as well as for price moves in the commodity itself. So how would you rank these different commodities from a potential point of view?
So not in terms of size, but in terms of potential upside from here?
Yeah, suppose you're an equity investor, but suppose you were a commodity investor. And you said,
okay,
I'm going to buy this commodity and put it away for the next 3 years. How would you rank the potential upside in the different assets you invest in?
All right. You know, these are broad ranges, but, you know, oil's had such a run that we're agnostic. Yeah. $85 plus or minus $20, $30, we have no problem with that. Gas, the fact that it's still so much cheaper in the U.S. than it is the rest of the world, we see no reason why that can't go up pretty substantially from here. Uranium, having gone from 18 to 45, is still way too cheap, just like 137 the last decade or two decades ago was too high. We believe that, you know, somewhere between 60 and 90 makes sense if we're wrong about printing money being inflationary. And if it is inflationary, then probably higher than that. So we certainly think a doubling of uranium is not out of the question. If gold is a commodity, we think it's worth $200 or $300 more than it is now. If gold is money, we think it's worth $2,000 or $3,000 more than it is now. But very importantly, we are, as you point out, equity investors. So what we do is buy the commodities that are undervalued, and we buy them at an undervalued price for that. And so we've been able to buy a bunch of companies that happen to own uranium and natural gas and gold. And if we are completely wrong about liking these commodities, we think we still make money on the stocks. They are trading below liquidation value in many of the cases we're talking about. So as one of our friends put it, we have non-decaying optionality. So we like the stocks better than we like the commodities, but in terms of the commodities to your question, gold, copper, silver, platinum, natural gas are much more undervalued than the ones that people are excited about. We also like the fundamentals for copper and nickel and lithium and these things, but they are not as undervalued as the things we're talking about.
Thank you. And once again, if you would like to signal with questions, please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone. Again, that is star 1. And we'll go ahead and take a question from Philip Bradshaw with Merrill Lynch.
Hey, Dave. Hope all is well. Happy 2022.
You too.
Just wanted you to touch base on the Kazakhstan investment. It's always a little difficult to explain to clients why that's in there. And then do you have any holdings or consideration for hydrogen investments with energy or like fission energy at all?
I can take the Kazakhstan question. So we actually own two companies in Kazakhstan. One's their largest dominant bank, Halyk Bank, and then the larger position, that's a small position, the larger position is Kazatomprom, and they produce 40% of the world's uranium, very low cost, huge assets. It has that optionality to higher uranium prices that Dave just mentioned in the last question. So there's lots to like about this company, and we especially like it because it is trading so cheap because of these this geopolitical discount. And when you're owning this as part of a diversified portfolio, you can diversify away a lot of this risk. As Dave pointed out, some of the geopolitical risks might transpire. Many of them won't. And so, we might lose on some, but we might make it up on other areas of the world. So that's typically, how we look at these sorts of things.
Yeah, it's interesting. We talk about the free optionality. So we think the price of uranium and natural gas is going to go much higher. But at current prices, Kazatomprom mints money and Gazprom in Russia mints money. They mint money. And then if the prices double, then we'll do a whole lot more. And so we think we are way overcompensated for that risk. The second part of the question was, Pigeon. Yeah. You know, we try to know our strengths and weaknesses, and whether it's technology or fission reactions or biotechnology or even mining, we don't go for the innovators. A lot of people are good at that, and you know, out of every 50 innovators, you know, 49 of them lose money and people make untold money on the other one. Our style is to wait and see who wins, and sometime in the next 10 years there'll be a bear market and we get to buy, you know, Genentech and biotech for a song, or you know, EDS, or before they got bought out in a song and technology. So yeah, with innovation, people come with things that work really great until you try to scale it. And there's been a few times in my 40 years where people have been really excited about fission or fusion. So if fusion works, you know, great, then wonderful. That's great for all society. But trying to guess who's going to win is typical fission nuclear now. You know, that we, of course, have invested in lots of different ways. And if people come up with the smaller reactors, that'll be even better for uranium and for society. But, yeah, we wait and see what works and then wait until, you know, Ben Graham's Mr. Market doesn't like it sometime in the future. So there's others that can give you a better answer than I can on who the winners are going to be.
And that does conclude the question and answer session. Mr. Ibin, I'll now turn the call back over to you for any additional or closing remarks.
All right. Well, the market's getting very, very interesting, and you know, that poses challenges, but we think lots of opportunity, and we appreciate all of the good questions and conversation and everybody's support. And you know, happy 2022 to everybody.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. We do thank you for your participation. Have an excellent day.